When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The History of Egypt podcast is a member of the Agora Podcast Network. Visit agorapodcastnetwork.com to hear more wonderful shows from many talented colleagues. Hello everyone, and welcome to a History of Egypt podcast interview. My guest today is Heba Abdel-Gawad. Heba Abdel-Gawad is the lead researcher for the project Egypt's Dispersed Heritage. This is a research and public outreach project that aims to put modern Egyptians and their stories at the forefront of conversations and approaches to ancient Egypt. For most of Egyptology's history, the scientific and historical work has focused on European and American institutions and scholars. In the 21st century, there is a growing movement to bring Egyptians back into the fold, so to speak, of their country's heritage. Heba works in this field, as well as curating museum exhibitions aimed at presenting the voices and faces of Egyptians in history, both modern and ancient. As you will see, Heba is a passionate and insightful commentator. I expect we will hear much more from her in the future. Please join me in welcoming Heba Abdel-Gawad to the History of Egypt podcast.
Okay, Heba, good morning and welcome to the History of Egypt podcast.
Hi, it's lovely to be talking to you at this, well, it's very late at night for me, so I know it's like, what time is it at your end?
For me, it is just after 11 a.m.
Okay, well, yeah.
So for those of my listeners who aren't necessarily following at the moment, how are things in Cairo right now?
Well, it's too hot, but it's not as hot as it should be for like August. So I don't know what, what maybe that's the bit of climate change that we're getting here. Like it would get cooler for us than the rest of the planet. So I don't know, maybe I don't want to sound like awful, but that might be the good side of climate change for us here. And apart from that, we've got, I don't know if I can call it a lockdown, but it's a semi-lockdown. Mm-hmm. Like you're obliged to wear masks everywhere, obviously. And like, social distancing is something that is very difficult to happen in Egypt for anyone, or perhaps in the Middle East. That's like, it's not something that people can easily grasp. So yeah, but at least, you can tell that some of the behaviors are changing in the sense of like you don't kiss every single person you see anymore. Sure. You can just say hi from a distance. So that's that's the COVID impact on us.
So you're working primarily in Cairo, and you're able to work from home at the moment, which is fortunate.
Yeah.
So before we start asking about your earlier projects, what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on the Egypt's Dispersed Heritage Project. It's like between me and Alice Stevenson. Alice Stevenson, she's the principal investigator at UCL, and I'm like the lead researcher for it in Cairo, conducting all the activities and engagements here. And the project is it's just I never like to call it engagement, but it's we're trying to foster and develop a dialogue with the various community groups in Egypt surrounding how and why artifacts from Egypt left to the rest of the world by the British presence in Egypt between 1880 and 1981. So yeah, the scale of the scope of the dispersal of Egyptian artifacts by British collectors, excavators from Egypt to the world. So yeah, so we're doing a variety of events on, and
that sounds like a very big project.
Yeah, it is. It's very exciting. It's very interesting. It's very interesting because I've always dealt with those questions very academically, and that's perhaps the first time that I can see how the non-academics tend to see such evidence. And particularly it's important for me to witness firsthand the emotional legacies of colonialism and the impact. And because it's one thing me being Egyptian and being an Egyptologist and feeling all such legacies looking into the archive, but working with other non-Egyptians and like when they get introduced to the information for the first time and you see how they react to it is, I don't want to call it refreshing because that's because it's usually sad emotions, but it's truly eye-opening. And I it's one of the reasons why I hope more Egyptians can get involved in the story of Egypt, in the making of Egypt's history, because they've got a lot to contribute to,
How did that project begin? What was the start of it?
Well, initially there was Alice's project, the Artifacts of Excavation, which is perhaps we can provide the listeners with links to the website because it's extremely useful. All the distribution lists, and you can actually trace excavations and how objects from excavation traveled from Egypt to the world through British excavators, British collectors, etc. So it's the Artifacts of Excavations, which got all summed up in her magnificent book, Scattered Finds. And I've been in touch, or we did work together initially, or they've hosted a conference that was organized by the Artifacts of Excavation project, where I presented a paper on Egyptian perceptions of repatriation and Western museums based on some social media research that I've been conducting since 2015. And then Alice and I started a conversation where we were discussing how we can include Egyptians in the story of the Artifacts of Excavations, or the Scattered Finds. So we started working on translating the website, making the findings more available to Egyptian audiences by having the website translated into Egyptian Arabic. And then there was an opportunity to apply for follow-on funding, which is necessarily for impact, where you can take, because it's a part of the funding scheme in the UK, like the HRC, if you're awarded a project, then you are offered an opportunity to apply again for a follow-on to take your results, to take your findings to the public. And then we thought, why don't we take them back to Egypt? So we did apply. But we initially, how it came together is that we've done I've done like a scoping exercise trying to research who would benefit most from this, or which community groups within Egypt would benefit most from this, because we were thinking of, we don't want it to be a top-down type of project where we take the findings and we organize lectures or workshops where we tell the Egyptians, this is the information, here you go. But we wanted to make something that is meaningful out of it, but equally beneficial. And it was part of our bigger aim of how we can center Egyptian communities into this conversation, or into the histories of archaeology, the histories of Egyptian archaeology. Because currently, as you know, there is a big wave for confronting colonial legacies in Western museums or in disciplines that have been embedded in colonialism, or like who came out and about out of colonialism, which archaeology, especially in Egypt and the Middle East, is one of them. And we felt that one aspect that is missing, which is crucial, is the actual communities who have been previously colonized, where their voices are totally absent from this conversation, and the conversation is turning into one that is very academic and very Western. So we weren't really sure that this is going to achieve anything. So we felt that we can use our project as an opportunity to offer a way where we can confront those colonial legacies with and by and for the Egyptians, and at the same time try to offer an example of how you can use these same collections and archives that are the outcome of colonialism, but you can use them to serve the communities back in the source, back in the countries of origin. So the only way for us to do this was to have some sort of a people-centered approach where we identify a few community groups and we identify a few initiatives that were already taking place, which we can become part of rather than us introducing ourselves as like outsiders, getting into the community and offering service. We wanted to be part of something that is already ongoing so we can benefit the community and also be part of it at the same time. So we collaborated initially while drafting the application, and the whole application was designed in conversation with all our Egyptian partners, so with two community schools and community initiatives in Egypt, one called Educate Me and the other one is called Tawasul, and they are both based in some of Egypt's most or Cairo's most deprived neighborhoods, and interestingly they are also nearby the two big museum projects, the two new big museum projects currently, which is the Grand Egyptian Museum and the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization, the NEMEC. So we felt that this could be a way to warm them up, that once the museums open, that they can feel that they are, that they also belong to the museum, they also belong to this part of history, rather than them feeling that it's just for tourists and because of they are because of their social and economic conditions, they are dismissed or pushed away out of the gates of the museum. So we felt that this could be a way to help them get included into the conversation. And we've also working with a variety of comic artists. The reason why we felt that we wanted to enter into a dialogue with the Egyptian communities, but in a way that could be accessible for everyone in terms of literacies, but in a way that also captures the spirit of Egypt, the spirit of Egypt and its character. So we chose comics to be our way, funny comics, not the type of comics, not the Marvel, like not just superheroes type of comics, but we have superheroes, but we also have like the humorous comics, which is how we engage on social media, because Egypt is big on social media, as everyone knows. This was also a way that we can engage, but equally it's a platform where people can respond back. So it's a two-way conversation that can happen. So we tend to post bi-weekly comic strips with Nasser Jr., the magnificent comic artist, our wonderful Nasser, where we offer the series of Nasser and Heba and Egypt's dispersed heritage. So we felt that we can convert the conversation that me and him have behind the scenes into the actual comic, so people can get totally engaged with us in the whole process. So we tend to transform the discussions that we have into a comic strip. That's why me and Nasser are the main characters of the comic. It's not it's not narcissist or anything, just for people to know, like there is a good reason behind it. It's not just us being mean or anything, so or looking out for fame. And then we've got Al-Uzba. And that's an adult comic, and the adult comic scene has been has very much revived in Egypt after 2011, the political events in 2011. But it remains, although it has revived so much, but it's still underrepresented within the community. And we felt that this is where the youth tend to engage the most. So we collaborated with the Al-Uzba. And that's an adult comic, an adult Egyptian comic. It's one of the leading Arabic-speaking adult comic. And we chose them because they are the superheroes, but their superheroes are inspired, but not only ancient Egypt, but equally all the layers of Egypt's heritage and history. So they fit quite well in our aim of confronting colonial legacies, and part of the colonial legacies is dismissing the rest of the layers of Egypt's history and focusing only on pharaonic Egypt. So that was one of the reasons. And they are also the power that fights evil for good, and they stand by the vulnerable. And we believe that Egyptian communities are quite vulnerable when it comes to the reconstruction of Egypt's past. They are usually isolated and disenfranchised, both intellectually and physically. So we felt that they could be the superheroes that help us bring justice to the Egyptian communities. The final comic artist, but not the least, is Dina Muhammad, who I'm a big fan, because she's a feminist comic artist, and that's my reason. Because she's the one behind Al Qahira, the hijabi superhero. So I can personally totally relate, which is like confronting Western stereotypes and stigmas. So yeah, so this is it. And for Dina, because she's very interested in confronting again Western narratives and Eurocentricism. So she could be our way into offering perhaps an Egyptian female eye view into things, but equally in how we can offer a non-Eurocentric view of Egypt past, or offer an alternative, like reverse colonialism, through her work, which she does specialize in. Mm-hmm. And least, we are also working on a storytelling project, which is a surprise, which relies on Egypt traditional storytelling format or tradition, which could be equally a street performance, which would be performed in the community schools that we're currently working in Tukitni and Tawassul. And something that came recently, and this wasn't a partner that we had initially, but after we started the project worked, and after we started making some, I don't know if I can call it impact, but people became more aware of us. So we've been contacted by few other Egyptian initiatives, like Arabayt al-Hawadith, or the storytelling truck in Sharia, which also tends to go around the Delta, offering storytelling workshops to vulnerable children or those who come from a deprived background. And we're currently working with them into offering some storytelling sessions in the Delta as well, using our comics and using the outputs that we've got so far. And we'll be linking through the five, we are doing this. So these are the Egyptian partners that we've got, and these are the Egyptian outputs, but we've got also, we're doing this through our five UK partners, because the whole idea is how, as I said, center the Egyptian communities into the colonial legacies of Western museums. So we felt that we want to foster a dialogue between these UK museums and these UK institutions and the Egyptian communities. So we're working with five UK museums, the Peachey Museum of Egyptian Archaeology, Edinburgh, the National Museum of Scotland, based in Edinburgh, Manchester Museum, Liverpool Museum, and the Horniman Museum and Gardens, and the Egypt Exploration Society, which is our main archival institution partner. And we're linking the resources and the collections in these six UK partners with the Egyptian communities. And we're working also in linking the community schools that we've got with UK schools through the educational departments in both the Horniman Museum and the National Museum of Scotland. So we're trying a real hangout between Egyptian kids and British kids, and trying to make them both perhaps understand why is ancient Egypt in the UK, and what can we do about this, and how we can bring both cultures together in a way that could be meaningful for both sides. So yeah.
Yeah, that's actually really, that's very comprehensive and really interesting. It sounds like a massive project, but it also sounds like an extremely important one. And I like the fact that there's sort of different branches, like the comic strips in various forms, and the community events, and then social media as well. It sounds like you're tackling the problem from several directions at once, which is perhaps a really good way to do it. Whereas maybe conventionally museums would start with their exhibition, and then they would try to branch out from that. But maybe this is taking an alternative route, which might have very strong impact.
Museums usually tend to use the quick fix of a focus group. But then again, focus groups, they are never totally representative, and it's only one way of amplifying voices. And it's only through the curatorial field in the museum. which makes whatever happens, as you said, just an exhibition. But then the museum is made up of a variety of departments and through which other cultures are represented, like, for example, the educational department or the programming and the activities. And I think that the only way to truly decolonize is not only to focus on how the objects are displayed or if they should be repatriated or not, but equally on how we speak about those cultures in the museum as a whole, not just in how they are displayed, because the museum is not only its displays, it tends to do a lot of activities, but for some reason the decolonization process is focused only on displays, as if, or repatriation, as if this is the only problem. But I have to say, like, the educational departments, as well as the activities and programming, have equally the same effect, if not more, because they tend to, it's more of a two-way dialogue with the audience rather than an object that is displayed with a label where people just read it and just move on. But yeah, having like school groups or something like, or programming activities, that can be the real way where you can change how a culture is represented within a museum in a way that can truly bring justice, or perhaps set the record straight for those who've been totally dismissed or totally silenced or unwritten from the conversation. So that's what we're trying to do. That's why we're focusing on a variety of activities that are not only curatorial or that are not only focused on labels or focused on display. We're looking into the museum as a whole.
That's really, really excellent. I like that idea. So before you began working on the Dispersed Heritage Project, you also curated an exhibition at the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology. And it was titled Egypt's Ordinary Woman, although I've also seen it referenced as Listened to Her.
Yeah, Listened to Her, yeah.
For those of my listeners who aren't familiar with it, I'll provide links to the online information. But how did this particular project begin?
It was a very, very kind invitation from Anna Garnett and Helen Pike. Anna Garnett, the curator of the Petrie Museum of Egyptian and Sudanese Archaeology, and Helen Pike, she's the head of programming at UCL Culture. And it came about after an event they had on women in Egypt in general. And there I gave a presentation on modern Egyptian women, or like the struggles and the activism of modern Egyptian women. And there has been the women history month, let's say, currently, that, or like it's becoming an annual theme in the UK, in museums and universities, where there is like a dedicated month for like pioneering women. And I felt that I'm not into very much the way the history of women gets reconstructed currently, because there is so much focus on the pioneering women or those who have broke the glass ceiling. And there is very, very little, if any, emphasis on the ordinary women who, for them, sometimes make it through the day is in itself an act of activism. So there is a need to celebrate everything that doesn't have to be a Nobel Prize. Like, I don't have to be a winner of a Nobel Prize for the world to acknowledge my contribution as a woman, because our life is difficult and different anyway than men. Let's put it this way.
Sure.
So any sort of contribution we make, no matter how minor, should be celebrated. And I feel that this is particularly problematic for the women from the Middle East, because we are usually summed up in our headscarves. That's, we're only seen through our hijab. And that's the only act of feminism that people want to have with us, is us taking off the scarf, and that would fix our problems. And there is very little understanding of how feminism is, there is a universal, women's struggle is universal, but solutions can only be local. And because there is a very, feminism is becoming more or less of a very much of a Western construct, that it doesn't accept that this doesn't work in all parts of the world, and that this is, being a Western model doesn't necessarily have to make it an international model. So that was my aim. My aim was, like, first of all, we need to celebrate the ordinary women, because we are usually called as Egyptians, Egyptian-like women. We are known as the daughters of Nefertiti, or but I'm the daughter of Nefertiti, so where is my royal treatment? Because obviously none of us gets the royal treatment that Nefertiti had. And there is so much emphasis on, even in ancient Egypt, on the queens, and very little do we talk about the ordinary women in ancient Egypt, who I think were the true ones behind the culture. Not only the queens, at least the queens had the bloodline. So for them, Hatshepsut fighting Thutmosis III, yeah, amazing, great. But it's not like also those women who were farming, doing all the day-to-day work, who were really struggling and who might have not even knew that the queen was called Hatshepsut. Let's face it. We know this because we have access to the hieroglyphs. Most of the Egyptians, even then and during ancient Egypt, couldn't read or write much of the text that we are able to decipher so easily today. So I felt that that could be a way that we talk about women, but the ordinary women. And for people to see that activism can come in a variety of ways, that the model that is presented in the West is not the absolute only model, and that there is so much celebration of the activism of Western women that we are totally dismissed from the conversation as if we do nothing. And that was also because of, it was the same time as the Me Too movement. And it was, I have to say, an article that really irritated me, where we should really export Me Too to the Middle East. Although women in Egypt have been fighting sexual harassment since 2011, and we've had mass protests in Egypt since 2011-2012, and Egyptian visual artists and graffiti artists, female graffiti artists, they took the streets of Cairo and the walls as their battleground, and they've been spraying like really provocative, in-your-face graffiti. That this is actually that they are risking far more than the Me Too movement, I would say, but because it happens in Egypt, so it doesn't count as activism, or it doesn't as a wave that the rest of the world should replicate. Although I believe it should. So I felt like, hang on, we should change the narrative here. So that's what I did. I chose six single and collective stories between the working women, the women who work in the archaeological field work that've been working even since the time of Pichi, and one of them was a girl. And that is another issue also, because we tend to celebrate the workmen, but we ignore the women. So even when we are trying to bring justice to the Egyptians, we are very selective on which Egyptians at least the gender. So there is a focus on the Kuftis as the men, but we totally ignore that there were actually women on Pichi's workforce too. So there was bringing the story of the female workforce, bringing the story of Egyptian singers and performers, and the political activism, the political activist that because of her, perhaps we might have had the revolution in 2011. She was the first one to fight she was the first one to fight for equal pay for women and men, and against the selling, the factories, the privatization of public industries in Egypt. And then there was the collective of the Egyptian women who were against sexual harassment. And there was Dina Muhammad, the same comic artist that we're currently collaborating with. I've highlighted her work in the Qahira, the comic superhero, because it's a hijabi superhero. And it was her way to defy how Western feminism tends to misrepresent us.
No, absolutely. That's an important part that's often gets overlooked, either consciously or unconsciously. Either the author chooses to ignore them, or they just don't even think to investigate them.
We had also 10 objects relabeled by Egyptian women, non-Egyptian women. And it was really interesting because they were female-related objects, and it was perhaps the first time where we offered this alternative labeling in a Western museum done by exclusively Egyptian women. It was extremely interesting because the labels that they put were very provocative, and they were very sincere and emotional. And it was a way of us to rethink of the typologies that we tend to frame objects in Egyptology, which are very pragmatic, and we tend to ignore the emotional side of things. And that for me was interesting, because we tend to label every object as ritual-based object, that's usually the thing. Like that's the solution for every object we don't understand why it was used. We just say that it was ritual related. But the work that or the labels they offered at least showed me personally that there are other ways of looking at objects that is not only ritual. Yeah.
Fantastic. Based on the work you've done so far and the experiences you've had around that, how do you think museums, let's just say generally, the sort of a general museum can improve in these respects moving forward? How can they provide better and more meaningful representation of source communities?
Well, if you look at it, there is the side of the policies and there is the practice itself. Mm-hmm. So for the policies, I would argue for a structural change in terms of the workforce within the museum itself. Because at the end of the day, the background does have an impact on the way you see things. And if all your workforce is white, and apologies for that, then it's very difficult for you to make change, no matter how much you collaborate with communities, because you've got your limitations already. The way I see things would be different than the way you see things. That comes from our upbringing, that comes from our exposure and from our environment. And from the way we perceive ourselves and the world around us. Mm-hmm. So that would be the aim. More people of color, more people of minorities, more people from the source communities, who many of them are currently diaspora in most of the Western countries that host objects from elsewhere around the world. And I'm sure that they've got the enough expertise to be able to become part of the actual real workforce, moving beyond the lowest steps of the ladder, of the employment ladder, like moving beyond the cleaning services. I'll be honest, moving beyond the cleaning and security services, which is where you would tend to see the diversity of museums the most. But moving forward, there has to be, and that has to become, I would say, if it starts as positive discrimination, then be it. If there is explicitly that we ask for people from certain backgrounds to apply for certain jobs, then I think that if this is what it has to take, then perhaps that could be the way that employment is fair, because they've been already misrepresented for so long. So there is this side of the policies of having more within. In the side of practice, I think that we need, as I said, to look at the museum as a whole, because there is the display, but there is also the social media for the museum. There is equally the programming and activities. There is the educational activities. There is the marketing. There is the exhibition shop. These are all parts of the museum that does contribute to how certain culture is represented, not only the display. And the only way for real change to happen, or for more source communities to be amplified, is for them to be more. I would say again, amplified in all those departments, not only in the display, because in the display, this is just a tick box that we're doing, but that doesn't change the real stories, the real narrative in the head of the visitor. So so that would be it. And I think that it's about time that also museums realize that they shouldn't be a happy place. They shouldn't be where you get sanitized, clean stories. Like, it's a place where history is messy, and history is all about struggle. And the more, like, history is only narrated through actually the sad days more than the happy days. We tend to, you know, that's like, if you get like in the calendar on this day, it would usually be a series of like misachievements, and then one person won the Nobel Prize or something. But this is it. History is made up of events, and interestingly, or perhaps ironically or sadly, most of these events are not happy events. So if we get the museum to tell the real stories, not only the stories that they think that people can handle, but the real stories of the source communities, the real story behind how an object ended up being in the museum, not only to say it's part of colonialism, but we have to say what was also included in colonialism, because the narrative of colonialism of museums is equally a very, it was a very peaceful process. They never acknowledge the amount of lives that were lost for colonialism and the resources exploited for colonial for colonialism, and the emotional baggage that communities still today are still struggling with from such acts. Mm-hmm. So unless we acknowledge this openly in all the departments of the museum, not only in the display, only then change can happen. And that can only happen if the if the source communities are truly part of the conversation, not only a one-off exercise or like a one-off exhibition where we have few voices here and there contributing, but they have to be part of the process of the making of this history, be it the diaspora living in those countries, or be it the communities which you can easily engage with online. And they are already, if we're talking about the case of Egypt, Egyptians are already communicating on the social media handles of Western museums. And most of the commentaries they make is very moving and is very emotional. And it shows that there is such a deep hurt when, like, it's a very emotional scene for you to see part of your history elsewhere where others are boasting about it, where you are totally deprived of that. And the commentaries that you get, that the Egyptians tend to post on Western museums' social media handles, are truly moving, that at times I wish that they could read really the Arabic there for them to acknowledge the real harm that has been done. And also to realize that colonial practices are still well and alive and kicking. It's not just something of the past, it's still there, to the extent that if I post something on Arabic on an Egyptian object that is displayed elsewhere, not in Egypt, even if it's from modern Egypt, the person who's behind the social media handle wouldn't understand what I'm saying. He would have to rely on Google Translate because he wouldn't be able to read and write Arabic. So that in itself is telling.
Absolutely. So social media obviously offers a very good opportunity for outreach, but then of course there's also the fundamental structure of museums as organizations, which needs to adapt and reflect the realities of both the histories around these collections and also where they're going to be moving forward, because history is not static, it's constantly changing, and maybe museums can sometimes seem quite out of date in terms of how their organization is actually arranged in some respects. Okay, so moving now to your career, both as a museum curator, public outreach specialist, and as an Egyptologist, what was your early attraction to the field? What inspired you to get involved in this?
Well,
big question.
Yeah, it is a big question indeed. I have to say, I don't know if it's for the right reasons, but I've always loved history, and it was due to my dad, I have to say, because he's a big fan of history, and he's an avid reader in history. So we've always had history books hanging around the house, and and he did encourage me to read a lot. But my issue was that I've seen how we're always very nostalgic to the past, and we feel sorry for our present. And the reason why I enrolled in Egyptology was just for me to try to understand what really happened. Because we tend to narrate, or there is this narration of this victorious past of Egypt, like glorious one. And then looking around you, growing up in modern Egypt, you would feel, why aren't we leading the world as we were in ancient times? And that was my motivation. I was just curious to know what happened, like, or what went right or wrong, I don't know. For me to realize that the past, later on, I only after I became, I don't know if I call myself Egyptologist or researcher in Egypt history, or I don't know. It doesn't really matter. It's just my degree was called a degree in Egyptology, so I don't know. But after I became like someone who's deeply interested in this, I realized that the problem is not in just what happened, but the problem is in the way that the history is narrated, that that is narrated through the kings and queens, and the ordinary Egyptians are totally ignored, and that's why we tend to see it very glorious, while we miss that. well, for the rest of the Egyptians, ancient Egypt wasn't a really glorious, victorious place. they had to work really hard, and they earned really little, and they were totally discriminated against and exploited. So nothing really happened. that was like when I was saying, like, what happened from the past till the present. That was my motivation, only for me to realize that this has always been the case.
Sure. Yeah.
It's just the way it's narrated to us that can make us feel belittled.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, that's a good approach. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So moving forward, once you started to pursue it academically, what are some of your sort of most notable or favorite experiences working in the field of we'll just call it Egyptology generally, but sort of what are some of your favorite experiences working in this profession?
It's the Beyond Beauty exhibition, and that was a turning point in my whole life. Maybe in my whole life, because I met really, really, really people that I truly love and admire, and I owe them so much. It was a turning point because I've always known that being an Egyptian and an Egyptologist is a blessing and a curse, because I feel like there is this perception that if I'm Egyptian and Egyptologist, I'm perceived as the representative of the whole of Egypt. So if I get invited, let's say, to a panel or whatever, so I'm the tick box that Egypt is represented. Here we go. That's Heba for you. So we bring an Egyptian voice to fix it. So that's all the problems fixed. And it's a curse in the sense that you could, because of how some of the colonial legacies are still persisting, you would find that because you are an Egyptian Egyptologist, you can be equally silenced and dismissed because of being Egyptian too. Regardless, you are still seen as less, or of you come as at a lower grade of how things are.
Absolutely. It's sort of they bring you out because it looks good, and then they, after that, they ignore you.
Yeah, and then they take you out because it looks bad, like. Yeah, so yeah, but it was the exhibition Beyond Beauty at Two Temple Place, where I felt that actually being an Egyptian and an Egyptologist is nothing but an asset, that there is so much I can contribute by that. There is so much agency that if I'm just offered the opportunity, that there is so much change that I can bring, not I as Heba, but not me as myself, as me in the person as Heba, but me as my background and my experience can allow me to achieve things that perhaps a non-Egyptian creator wouldn't. And maybe I was lucky enough because I'm more or less currently part of both worlds. I've lived in the UK for extensive amount of years, that I understand the system very well, and I'm more acquainted with the Western culture, and I see how the others other us and how the others see us. And I also see how we other the West and how we see the West. So I could be the mediator, more or less. And the amount of agency that I was given in this exhibition is one of the reasons where I am where I am today. I'm able to achieve what I'm achieving today. Because we were allowed in this exhibition not only to change the narrative about ancient Egypt, but to also change even how Egypt is displayed in the exhibition shop. I was allowed to work with an Egyptian NGO where we brought up merchandise from Egypt, and we weren't only selling products, but we were selling products and helping single women or underrepresented communities in Egypt to gain some money by having their products sold in an exhibition in the UK. So you can sell products, but for a good cause that can go back to the source communities. And that's what I meant by how even the exhibition shop, or even the shop within a museum, in a Western museum, can still help the source communities. Rather than selling the tacky Chinese products, you can bring some fair trade or meaningful merchandise in the exhibition shops. And we were able also to organize a series of events that surrounding modern Egypt and invite modern artists. But equally, we were able to work very closely with the Egyptian embassy and try to have them part of the conversation, that we have the whole of Egypt represented, the whole of the communities in Egypt represented. And it was a difficult time for Egypt, because then there was a travel ban from the UK to the various of touristic sites, and we felt that we can also use or make people see how heritage abroad could be used as an international relation asset, where we can forge some diplomacy or like bring some good and perhaps reassure people that they can go back and visit Egypt by having an endorsement from the Egyptian embassy and having the tourism ministry in Egypt making some advertisements within the exhibition and contributing as well to how people Egypt can be safe to go back to. So yeah, it's not just an exhibition about, because this is what I hate the most. It's there is so much focus on ancient Egypt that we are totally dismissed and ignored. And the way ancient Egypt is presented oppresses us so much that it does have a real, not only emotional impact, but equally economical. Because a lot of the communities get totally disenfranchised and at times displaced from around sites for the benefit of tourists. So the way we frame ancient Egypt, be it in a museum or in an academic book, does have a real impact on the source communities today, that this does need to change. So yeah, that was I'm becoming too emotional now. That was a really, really one of the best experiences that I've ever had in my life beyond beauty at Two Temple Place.
That's excellent.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
All right, moving now to our last question. This is something that I ask everybody who does an interview with the show, and it sort of gives an insight into personalities and priorities or interests. And my question is that if you could answer one question from ancient Egyptian history, if you could find the definitive answer to one problem or issue or question, what would you choose to know about ancient Egypt and why?
Oh, that's you know what, I've always been interested, talking about ordinary Egyptians, I've always been interested to know how the ordinary Egyptians felt about ancient Egypt, or felt about how did it feel to be a citizen in ancient Egypt, or to be like under the rulership of the pharaoh in Egypt, because I would be, because I understand that the text that we've got, this is a very sanitized version, and it's what they want us to believe or feel, especially the priests, and it's written by those who had the upper hand. But we know nothing about those who've been at the very lower, at the very low of the social strata. How did they feel about living or being in Egypt? Because we tend to draw a very rosy picture of ancient Egypt. This is the place of technology. This is the place of inventions, culture, civilization. But I can't help but feel that I don't want to get into controversial issues like slavery and the pyramids, etc. But I'm not really sure that the ordinary Egyptians were very happy to have been that exploited as we think they were, because they're human beings after all, and I'm sure they were truly deprived and they were struggling from what I can tell. So I would really love to know how an average Egyptian back then in ancient times felt about how did he perceive the state of affairs then, or maybe like what type of chit chat they used to have, like political chit chat, like Were they complaining like us? Like, yeah. I would love to know all what we don't get in the actual record, because of they weren't able to read or write. So
absolutely, yeah,
that's the crucial information we're missing.
So maybe what you'd like to do is go back for a week and interview people, or just
I would love to. Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm a very people person. Like, I love talking to people. So I would just walk around the streets and just stop everyone and ask them questions, befriend them, and want to truly know how they feel about being Egyptians then, or how, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's good.
How were their conditions?
I like that.
Yeah.
That's a very good answer. Thank you.
Okay, so, thank you. No, thank you for asking. It's a very interesting question. I've never thought about it. Yeah.
I find it brings an amazing variety of answers from different people.
Yeah.
Okay, so that brings me to the end of my questions. So, Heba, thank you very much for coming on to the History of Egypt podcast and discussing these. Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the very, very kind invitation. I did enjoy my time so much. Thank you so much.
Lovely. I'll let you head off to bed in a moment. But before I go, if my listeners want to find out more about you, I'll provide some links on the podcast website. And you're on Twitter and Facebook as well, I understand.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, and I look forward to speaking with you again in future.
Thank you so much. Same to you. Same goes for me. Thank you so much. Thank you.
My thanks to Heba for taking time out of her schedule to speak with us. See you next time on the History of Egypt podcast. Take care.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save.